Blog Talk Radio.
February 2016, Valentine's Day, but more of that in a minute. We're going to be remembering the birthday of one of the most significant scientific achievements in the history of mankind. Galileo Galilei was born tomorrow. 15th of February, but much longer ago than you and I would care to imagine. He was born in 1564. He was an astronomer and a physicist, an engineer and philosopher and mathematician. But he was really quite important, and he's remembered, not at the time, but afterwards, throughout the rest of history, I guess, scientific revolution during the Renaissance. He's been called the father of observational astronomy, or the father of modern physics. That's kind of lofty, don't you think? We know him for his brush with the Inquisition. They found him. He came up with this idea of heliocentrism, and that was very, very controversial at the time. This was building on the work of Copernicus and Tycho, earlier discoveries. But it wasn't possible for anybody to declare that the Earth, in God's creation, wasn't the center of the universe. That really ran contrary to the Roman Catholicism of the day. And they couldn't possibly support him. So they introduced him to the Inquisition in 1615. That was the Supreme Sacred Congregation of the Roman and Universal Inquisition. And what it was a series of tribunals developed by the Holy See in Rome. And it was responsible for prosecuting individuals who were accused of crimes relating to religious doctrine or alternate religious doctrine. You think about it, similar kind of mindset is still current today. This was the group that was sorting out heresies, and that included being a Protestant and being a sorcerer. So all of you alchemists, any type of blasphemy, Judaizing, witchcraft, and it censored. It was wildly effective in killing a lot of people. So our fellow here, Galileo, suffered the wrath. He was tried and found vehemently suspect of heresy. And he was forced to recant his science. He spent the rest of his days under house arrest. And that's where he wrote two new sciences. And he summarized the work he had done for 40 years. He called them kinematics and the strength of materials. But enough of that. You can study and read a little more about this enormously influential thinker. But if you will allow me a little bit of depth or breadth of conversation today, I've been working on, continuing to work on a paper. I think it's the best thing I've ever written, and I need you to help me with some aspects of respect. And here's how I came to that. The thinking is that one of the stumbling blocks, that one of the issues, one of the undercurrents that we haven't addressed is about the nature of change and reform or innovation and respect, the balancing point. So I started off, as most people would, I think, well, I did, like this. When people slip into a uniform, they morph. They are the essence of organization and coordinated purpose. In the mind, pack mentality occurs during indoctrination. When tasked with defending a culture, they are the stuff of armies and policing. For this mindset, rank, respect of rank is unquestioned. Masonry, on the other hand, deals in a deeper form of respect that answers a question that too often has left us to doubt our capability. For this respect, we owe much to the Renaissance. Like this. The legacy of the Renaissance is a belief in genius, something rarer than skill or talent, that would transform the arts. It took us from respect for the trained talent, manipulating the experience that is out there for all to know, to awe before the uniquely inspired self. From admiration to awe, from the imitation of nature to the recreation of nature. From the artist filling a patron's orders to the patron awaiting an artist's creations. James Russell Lowell observed that talent is that which is in a man's power. Genius is that in whose power a man is. In ancient Roman religion, the genius, Latin the begetter, was the ruling spirit that perpetuated a household or a family. Came to mean the guardian spirit of a guild or place or an individual, which a person might worship on his birthday. After Augustus, the genius of an emperor would be worshipped. The spirit of a woman or a goddess was known and worshipped as a Juno. Medieval Europe did not put high value on originality. If it had been proved that Leonardo da Vinci had copied the items of his notebooks from other books, it would have only increased respect for his learning and would not have stirred charges of plagiarism. Individualism, a novel expression to which a novel idea has given birth, did not enter our English vocabulary until 1835. That, when Tocqueville used it to describe what he found in America. But genius, suggesting originality, had deeper roots, supremely embodied in Michelangelo, the unique, unpredictable creator has cast a spell over the arts in modern times. Chagall, Dante, and Giotto were admired for the awesome immortality of their works. Yet the word divine was rarely applied to living artists or poets before the 16th century. Alberti in his work on painting in 1436 already saw in the artist a divine power. Leonardo too declared the painter's work nobler than that of nature, and his painter was a second god. The Portuguese painter Francesco da Holanda observed in Rome in 1538 that in Italy one does not care for the renown of great princes. It is the painter only that they call divine. During the Middle Ages, the artist had become a man of trained skills and disciplined life. The earliest painter's guild in the late 13th century oversaw the lives and works of members, their religious activities, their contracts of apprenticeship, and their relation to patrons. In Florence, after 1293, no one had civic rights who was not a member of his proper guild, and defiance of the guild was unusual. When Brunelleschi refused to pay his dues to the Guild of Building Workers in 1434, he was imprisoned for 11 days before the authorities secured his release to work at the cathedral. Brunelleschi, can you imagine? You know those pillars you see in the Vatican? Guilds were losing their monopolies, but not until 1571 did a decree exempt members of the Florentine Academy from guild membership. The Protestant Reformation, wary of images in churches, deprived painters and sculptors of their best traditional patron, the church. But about the same time, merchant bankers like the Medici created a more varied demand, offering the artist a new chance to be original. Respect. Now, I remember when I first read about the five different levels of charity, it really gave a new dimension, a new depth to a transaction, to an idea. It helped me to understand the connection of a charitable act with humility. And I owe Masonry a great deal, because that was the source that directed me to this information. And similarly now, on this question of respect, I think, and I suggest, yeah, put it to you, that Freemasonry is built around a deeper sense of respect. This sense of respect. The respect that is a power within itself. Or as Lowell said, it is that which is in a man's power, genius. That's talent within our power, but genius is that in whose power a man is. Genius. It gives perspective, obviously. But a good show today, I think, we have coming up. And I hope you like it. I'm going to get into the commentary. But first, just a little taste of something to set the mind. This is from a Swedish performer named Tord Gustafsson. Gustafsson. Yeah. Just a short little piece. Thank you. What's not to like? It's a good life. I want to put the question to you, though. But first, the commentary. Today's commentary is titled Tolerant Dialogue. When Masonic friends meet, maybe better to say when Masons meet, because it's assumed. Happy to meet, sorry to part. Before the beautiful nature of Freemasonry slips through our fingers, we need to extend understanding this group of boys, young and old. Why we shy away from the promises offered by our Masonic beliefs. Perhaps it is the residue of cynicism, maybe fear of the unknown, maybe even fear of success or a combination of this mixture. It takes a brave heart to follow an instruction hundreds of years old, worrying we are not ready, having not completed our training, knowing we don't understand the meaning of the gentle craft, or because humility is very hard on the ego. Like any red-blooded, self-absorbed genius, we will try everything to get out of the task until that day comes when it all makes sense. Welcome to the mind of a Mason, the true Mason. Turmoil, the doubt, the internal challenge. And without that challenge, without that examination, what's life worth? Now, the question that I have for you is about the gravity of genius. What would compel men to be part of an organization that has its roots in an unwritten history, and that we are antiquarians pieced together to reveal enough fact, but never completely. We always bring forward myth and mystery. Those are elements that are unassailable. Say what you like about them, you can mock them, but they're irrefutable. Make fun of the fairy tales taught to us as children, but each conveyed a very serious cultural moral lesson. Make fun of them if you will. We've sanitized them because we treat the children as if they're maybe idiot savants. We teach a notion of a world that is not as much unreal as disreal. We try to create a mindset that is constructed, not reactive, not observant, based on what we teach is the belief. Rather risky, you would think? Obviously. Explains a lot, doesn't it? What then would compel a group of people to form the Royal Society? These weren't laborers. These weren't bricklayers. These were genius congregated. Don't have to be a student or be at all competitive. The notion here is that get over that. That is simply a way of closing down the dialogue that we need. It interferes because it's disrespectful of genius. So the narrow-mindedness of that approach has no place in the Masonic focus. When we recognize genius, and when genius sits down with genius, it doesn't make us lesser. It reinforces our deeper sense of our respect for something that is beyond the ability or the personality of the man. And in that, it pulls us all together. Because after all is said and done, we can admire the genius of some. Is this closer to what you think may have pulled Freemasonry together and propelled it on a journey hundreds of years into the future? The notion of the respect. Do you seriously think that the order is based on respect of authority? For hundreds of years, through all walks of life, secular, not with anything to do with economic capability or control, nothing. So it doesn't speak to the gentry or the merchant class or the nouveau riche. But it does speak to the genius of the boy sitting on a park bench, shoeless, or the student that has a capacity to form perfection in what we refer to as best we can in music. Or when you see the marble being carved in a way that is perhaps in some way as human as looking at our own hand and recognizing that it is taking us beyond what we are. Is this about your mind, the mind, a mind, or is it about an indoctrination? The evidence that I see suggests we are based on genius. No, not to say that you are a member of Mensa or that we are smarter, but we have more insight. We're more aware without ever making claim about our brilliance or our capability. That's just crass. But to be able to appreciate the arts and to be able to appreciate genius, that makes us different. That demonstrates insight, awareness. That pulls back the veil of darkness to reveal what? The light is genius. The lost word. You can see easily how a vocabulary that comes from being a student of the craft allows us to articulate these ideas. But we must always respect and learn from the work of physics and math, mathematicians teach us. And Einstein taught us It's to take complex ideas and break them down into their simplest terms. One of the stories that I'm reminded of that I find very endearing and interesting about Albert Einstein was that you probably heard this story about his neighbor, the little girl, who was having difficulty with her maths. And she asked this very kind old man if he would come and help her. And he agreed. And he would attend with her and go through her arithmetic lessons. Albert Einstein. I just find that juxtaposition just remarkably endearing and tells me more, not about the man's mind, but about the personality. And we know about his fears and phobias. We know that. What we truly love is that the ideas this fellow had, even 100 years later, are coming to fruition, are being proved. Can you imagine? Even recently, a couple of days ago, he speculated, he theorized, it wasn't speculation, he theorized, based on what was known at the time, at a time when we didn't have the tools. But what we're claiming now is that scientists are claiming a stunning discovery in their full understanding of gravity by observing the warping of space-time generated by the collision of two black holes more than a billion light years from where we are. It's the culmination of decades of searching and could ultimately give us an indication, a little look at the Big Bang. Can you imagine? Triumph of science. Waves. Gravity and waves. And remember that he helped us to ask the question, why is gravity so weak? Anyway. Time reveres a genius. Here, I'm reminded of this when I'm looking at a letter written to by J.T. DeSolda. And this is from the 1723 Constitutions, edited by James Anderson. There was a dedication in it by Dr. de Solger. He was the deputy grand master at the time. And he was writing to His Grace the Duke of Montague. By order of His Grace the Duke of Wharton, the present Right Worshipful Grand Master of the Freemasons and his deputy, I humbly dedicate this book of the constitutions of our ancient fraternity to your grace. In testimony of your honorable, prudent, and vigilant discharge of the office of our Grand Master last year. I need not tell your grace what pains our learned author has taken in compiling and digesting this book from the old records, and how accurately he has compared and made everything agreeable to history and chronology so as to render these new constitutions a just and exact account of Masonry from the beginning of the world to your grace's mastership, still preserving all that was truly ancient and authentic in the old ones. For every brother will be pleased with the performance that knows it had your grace's perusal and approbation, and that it is now printed for the use of the lodges after it was approved by the Grand Lodge when your grace was Grand Master. All the brotherhood will ever remember the honor your grace has done them and your care for their peace, harmony, and lasting friendship, which none is more duly sensible than My Lord, your grace's most obliging, most obedient servant and faithful brother, J.T. de Solia, Deputy Grand Master. What would these men have in common? What respect? This gives us, Freemasonry gives us the opportunity to change things up, to upgrade, intellectually upgrade, simply by understanding deeper meaning. My goodness, I can't imagine a conversation with somebody that finds this tedious. It would be a waste of time for one, and a confusing distraction for the other. Better it never took place. The heart of Freemasonry, the gravity of Freemasonry, continues. So, the global world of Masonry is wobbling on its axis. Our equinox seems to be on a, 300-year cycle? A Masonic year. And so we've pulled away, and we are in the, we have perhaps come to the end of the winter of Freemasonry. And we're moving into the season of renewal, of growth. Not good, not bad, but reaffirming the life cycle. The beginning, the middle, and the end. Not of us, but of the season. Our numbers come, our numbers go. In places on the surface of the earth, we're persecuted and prosecuted. We're feared, we're loathed, we're ridiculed, we're mocked. We act silly and self-indulgent, and then we perform acts of such delicacy and nuance, and the success of these ideas is the beauty that no one knows it was perpetuated by a Freemason, and that is one of the ultimate satisfactions of a good man. How in the world would we ever gain any public relation traction acting like that? My goodness, the cynics go wild because they can't discover our hidden motivation. And how glib it sounds to turn and say to them, because when a person gives that deeply, without reservation, based on need, without craving their ego being stroked, without needing to compete, without bragging, the act of giving what you have to somebody in need is so deeply satisfying that it makes us happy. Happiness shared. And you share that happiness with others. No judgment of your fellow man. But that internal sense of purpose. Here. See what I mean? This is a tune by Bob Marley, sung by a very remarkable voice, Haley Lauren. Check it out.
Oh, by the way, these don't you treat me like a puppet on a string. No, 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 no. Oh, girl, I know how to do my thing. Don't start to be hit if you think I'm done. I wanna know when you're gonna come soon. I don't wanna wait in vain for you to love. I don't wanna wait in vain for you to love. I don't wanna wait in vain for you to love. No, because summer is here and I'm still waiting there. Winter is here and I'm still waiting there. Like I said, it's been 3 years since I'm not. Oh, and I still cannot the more. Oh, boy, is it feasible? I got to know now, for I do not the more. You see, in life, I know there's lots of grief. Oh, but your love is my relief. Tears in my eyes burn. Tears in my eyes burn. While I'm waiting, while I'm waiting for my turn. Oh, I don't wanna wait in vain for no love. I don't wanna wait in vain for no love. I don't wanna wait in vain for your love. No, because summer is here and I'm still waiting there. Winter is here and I'm still waiting there. Oh. I don't want to wait in vain for your love. No, I don't want to wait in vain for your love. I don't want to wait in vain for your love. No, 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 I don't want to, I don't want to, I don't want to, I don't want to, don't want to wait in vain. No, 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 I don't want to.
Music seems to set a tone, doesn't it? We spend a lot of time describing Freemasonry in terms of the governance and organization. I find that such a curious preoccupation. It doesn't really lead us to much in the way of human insight unless we pull back, hold that process at arm's length in the palm of our hand and think about how and why. What's been going on? Fascinating when our historians find these points of light in time, in events, and start to pull them together so so that they tell us, they add another chapter to the story. And I think the point is, by better understanding our organization, it helps to better understand ourselves and this quest for knowledge. Except I think that that's where we've been led astray. Because we can be very, very good historians. We can think about, read the papers and be amazed at the celebrity of the people, whether it was a prince writing a note that you can see at the Grand Lodge of Scotland, signed before he was the king, or Montague, or Anderson, names that just float through time, woven into the houses of the Stuarts and the governance, where at times monarch and church leading was the same. And where some, like Charles I, actually thought that there was a divinity to being the king. But let me give credit where credit is due, respect for the genius of the idea of a Grand Lodge, not for the workings, not for the domestic aspects, the housekeeping that goes on, that Grand Masters and Deputy Grand Masters and their boards perform around the world. I want to give credit where credit is due, and they deserve that. Here, like this. The United Grand Lodge of England is the governing body of the craft Freemasonry, controlling subordinate lodges which work only the 3 degrees of Entered Apprentice, Fellow Craft, and Master Mason. The Grand Lodge of England was formed on the 24th of June 1717 in London as the first Grand Lodge of the world. And this comes from John Hamill, Director of Communications, the United Grand Lodge of England, the craft, 1986. Now, this I find enormously profound and wonderful. It is highly likely that the spread of free and accepted masonry around the world was the result of the establishment of the Grand Lodge of England. This event is customarily held to have taken place in London on John the Baptist's day, 24 June 1717, and nearly 300 years later, yeah. And with the benefit of hindsight, that is how it must appear to us. But the statement begs another question, one of which hindsight offers less than we might feel comfortable with. What was the establishment of the Premier Grand Lodge of England the result of? What produced it? To just pop into existence? A note found attached to a manuscript copy of The Natural History of Wiltshire, 1685, written by the antiquarian John Aubrey, goes like this. This day, 18th of May, being Monday, 1691, after Rogation Sunday, is a great convention at St. Paul's Church of the Fraternity of the Adopted Masons, where Sir Christopher Wren is to be adopted as a brother. This is also reported in manuscripts of the contemporary diarist John Evelyn. He says, Sir Christopher Wren, architect of St. Paul's, was at a convention at St. Paul's in the 18 May 1691. A Freemason adopted a brother of that society. Sure have been kings of this sodality. So it was after he developed St. Paul's that he was adopted. Wren, most famous of the architect of, as the architect of St. Paul's, had been president of the Royal Society from 1680 to 1682. He was a famous architect who found himself considerably, found architecture considerably less compelling than his other scientific interests, especially microscopy and biology. Did you know? A polymath. Wren was an artist. He liked a challenge, and most architecture, once he had mastered the geometrical content, bored him. He was adopted as an accepted Freemason. Then, the very late date of that adoption, whatever that may have been, would be consistent with all that we know of accepted Freemasonry fellowship practice. Accepted Freemasonry, unlike the Masonry of Scotland that we have examined, was not, as far as we can tell, directly connected to the process of educating Freemasons. In Scotland, it was educating stonemasons. On the other hand, this adoption granted to the great Wren may have been more in the manner of the Scottish practice of admitting gentlemen to a stonemason's body or lodge. Perhaps the assembly craftsman experienced a fit of springtime enthusiasm, offering a sign of thanks for the work Wren's designs had provided for them. This adoption was certainly not an invitation to run the business of individual lodges. It was more likely a dignity granted in gratitude for Wren's role in handling disputes between craftsmen and employers over matters of wages and contracts. We know that Wren was the place of last resort in such disputes during his period, securing payment to a widow whose husband had died on the job, for example, was a matter of great importance to craftsmen working on long-term projects. When Wren's good offices were so used, to it attested in the rebuilding records of Lichfield Cathedral during the 1670s. It is even possible that Wren had formally joined the exception, but lower-ranking stonemason lodge members were simply unaware of it. Wren's connection with a distinct body of Freemasons is attested elsewhere. At his death in 1723, several newspapers referred to the architect as that worthy Freemason. We know that Wren's son joined a lodge of free and accepted Masons. Christopher Wren Jr. belonged to the old St. Paul's Lodge, which does not seem so surprising given the amount of time his father had to spend in the vicinity. The younger Wren served as the lodge's master in 1729, after his father's death. But since 1691, the date of Aubrey's account of Wren's adoption at St. Paul's Church, that lodge had met at the Goose and Gridiron Tavern in St. Paul's Churchyard. The first Grand Lodge was formed at the Goose and Gridiron. Christopher Wren Jr. was present when Mason contractor Edwin Strong, his son, and other accepted Freemasons placed the last stone on the lantern of St. Paul's in 1708. Edward Strong was an Oxfordshire Mason, the most important contractor to have worked on the cathedral. Strong was upper or senior warden of the Masons Company of 1694. Learn about Freemasonry, learn about the context, the why. We're running out of time again. How does this happen? I hope you'll come back and join me. We'll look at the great Masonic hijack. We're borrowing so heavily from Tobias Churton's work, Freemasonry, the Reality, to help us with this. Hold Freemasonry in the palm of your hand and examine it. It's remarkable for the utter genius behind it. Hindsight, we have the genius to use hindsight, if not the wherewithal to calculate our decisions using the geometry available to us. We still stumble along, but we are apprentices. We're not masters. We still stumble along doing our domestic duties until that next genius comes forward and builds, stands on the shoulders of the great men who've helped create what we have. Thank you for joining me today. Sun's trying hard to break out here. It's about close to minus 20. Beautiful, perfect Canadian winter's day. Cheers. Enjoy this. This is a little bit of music by a Canadian singer, Sophie Millman. It's become my favorite lately. See you soon.
sweet September.